Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. I'd like to thank you for supporting your local independent booksellers. Tonight, I am honored to introduce award-winning author Neal Stephenson as he presents and signs his latest work, Reamde. Neal is a best-selling author of several novels, including Snow Crash and Cryptonomicon, along with short fiction, as well as several essays on a variety of topics. His fiction is often difficult to categorize, moving from genre to genre with ease, sometimes within the same book. Though difficult to categorize, it is consistently exciting, while still being thoughtful and philosophical, which is certainly true of his newest book. Reamde deftly ties together a video game executive, Richard Forthrest, some of his family and employees, Chinese hackers, Russian mafia, and even terrorists, in a story that moves across the globe as well as through virtual space. The story quickly gains momentum and rarely slows down for a breather, yet the reader never gets lost in the twists and turns of the plot or the crowd of characters inhabiting the story. I could spend hours talking about this book, but I'm sure you'd rather hear it from Neal. So without further delay, please give me a warm welcome for Neal Stephenson.
Thanks for coming out. Congratulations to Tattered Cover on, what, 40th anniversary? I mean, not it's not tonight, is it? It's like roughly around this time somewhere. Okay. But anyway, congratulations anyway. So this is a thriller. In accordance with the Aristotelian unities of thrillers, it consists largely of people running around shooting at each other. So those parts aren't that great for reading because there are spoilers and they just don't read that well. But you need to sort of care at some level about the people who are being shot at. So the first part of the book has more introductory material about the characters, and that's the kind of stuff I'm going to be reading from. So I'm going to read three sections. Let me give you some background so that this makes sense. The main character is Richard Forthrest. He grew up on a farm in northwest Iowa. His father was a World War II hero. His older brother, John, was drafted into the Army, went to Vietnam, was maimed by a landmine. Richard, not wanting anything like that to happen to him, went to Canada, got involved in cross-border marijuana smuggling, made a lot of money, plowed that into a legitimate business, a resort, which he calls the Schloss, in the town, the fictional town of Elphinstone, British Columbia. That succeeded. He found himself with a lot of time on his hands. He spent it playing video games. From there, he came up with the idea of creating a new kind of massively multiplayer online role-playing game, MMORPG, called Terrain. He created a company called Corporation 9592 to build that game. It's based in Seattle. For those of you who haven't seen these games, it's the kind of thing where you're sort of immersed in an alternate reality, and you run around and engage in sword fights with goblins and demons and stuff like that. It's become very successful. So The action here begins back on the farm where Richard grew up in northwest Iowa. He's there for the family reunion, which happens around Thanksgiving every year. And the family is engaging in his favorite pastime, which is shooting guns. So, and he's just kind of wandering from group to group, acquainting himself or reacquainting himself with various family members as he goes around. Richard drifted in upon a small knot of people, mostly in their 20s, firing handguns. In a way he couldn't quite put his finger on, these had an altogether different look and feel from the ones who swarmed around Len. They were from a city, probably a coastal city, probably West Coast, not L.A., somewhere between Santa Cruz and Vancouver. A man with longish hair, tattoos peeking out from the sleeves of the five layers of fleece and raincoat he'd put on to defend himself from Iowa, was holding a Glock 17 out in front of him, carefully and interestedly pocking 9mm rounds at a plastic milk jug 40 feet away. Behind him stood a woman, darker skinned and haired than any here, wearing big, heavy-rimmed glasses that Richard thought of as Gen X glasses, even though Gen X must be an ancient term now. She was smiling, having a good time. She was in love with the man who was shooting. Their emotional openness, more than their hair or clothing, marked them as not from around here. Richard had come out of this place with the reserved, even hard-bitten style that it seemed to tattoo into its men. This had driven half a dozen girlfriends crazy until he had finally made some progress toward lifting it. But when it was useful, he could drop it like a portcullis. The young woman had turned toward him and thrust her pink gloves up in the air in a gesture that from a man meant touchdown and from a woman, I will hug you now. Through a smile, she was saying something to him, snapped into fragments as the earmuffs neutralized a series of 9mm bangs. Richard faltered. A precursor of shock came over the girl's face as she realized, he isn't going to remember me. But in that moment, and because of that look, Richard knew her. Genuine delight came into his face. Sue, he exclaimed, and then, for sometimes it paid to be the family genealogist, corrected himself. Zula. And then he stepped forward and hugged her carefully. Beneath the layers, she was bone slender, as always. Strong, though, she pulled herself up on tiptoe to mash her cheek against his and then let go and bounced back onto the heels of her huge insulated boots. He knew everything and nothing about her. She must be in her middle 20s now, a couple of years out of college. When had he last seen her? Probably not since she had been in college, which meant that during the handful of years that Richard had absentmindedly neglected to think about her, she had lived her entire life. In those days, her look and her identity had not extended much beyond her backstory, an Eritrean orphan, plucked by a church mission from a refugee camp in the Sudan, adopted by Richard's sister, Patricia, and her husband, Bob. Re-orphaned when Bob went on the lam and Patricia died suddenly. Readopted by John and his wife Alice so that she could get through high school. Richard was ransacking his extremely dim memories of John and Alice's last few Christmas letters, trying to piece together the rest. Zula had attended college not far away, Iowa State, done something practical, an engineering degree, gotten a job, moved somewhere. You're looking great, he said, since it was time to say something, and this seemed harmless. So are you, she said. He found this a little off-putting, since it was such transparent BS. Almost 40 years ago, Richard and some of his friends had been bombing down a local road on some ridiculous teenaged quest and found themselves stuck behind a slow-driving farmer. One of them, probably with the assistance of drugs, had noticed a similarity, which, once pointed out, was undeniable, between Richard's wide, ruddy cliff of a face and the back end of the red pickup truck ahead of them, thus the nickname Dodge. He kept wondering when he was going to develop the aquiline, silver-haired good looks of the men in the prostate medication ads on their endless seaplane junkets and fly-fishing idols. Instead, he was turning out to be an increasingly spready and mottled version of what he had been at 35. Zula, on the other hand, actually was looking great. Black Arab with an unmistakable dash of Italian, a spectacular nose that in other families and circumstances would have gone under the knife. But she'd figured out that it was beautiful with those big glasses perched on it. No one would mistake her for a model, but she'd found a look. He could only conjecture what style pheromones Zula was throwing off to her peers, but to him, it was a sort of hyperspace librarian girl geek thing that he found clever and fetching without attracting him in a way that would have been creepy. "This is Peter," she announced, since her boyfriend had emptied the Glock's clip. Richard noted approvingly that he checked the weapon's chamber, ejected the clip, and checked the chamber again before transferring the gun to his left hand and extending his right to shake. "Peter, this is my uncle Richard." As Peter and Richard were shaking hands, Zula told Peter, "He lives pretty close to us, actually." "Seattle?" Peter asked. "I have a condo there," Richard said, sounding lame and stiff to himself. He was mortified. His niece had been living in Seattle, and he hadn't known. What would the reunion make of this? As a sort of excuse, he offered up, "But lately I've been spending more time at Elphinstone." Then he added, "BC," in case that meant nothing to Peter. But an alert and interested look was already coming over Peter's face. "I've heard the snowboarding's great there," Peter said. "I wouldn't know," Richard said, "but everything else is pretty damn nice." Zula was mortified, too. "I'm sorry I didn't get in touch with you, Uncle Richard. It was on my list." From most people, this would have been mere polite cliché, but Richard knew that Zula would have an actual literal list and that call Uncle Richard would be somewhere on it. "It's on me," he said. "I should have rolled out the welcome mat." While stuffing more rounds into empty magazines, they caught up with each other. Zula had graduated from Iowa State with a dual degree in geology and computer science and had moved to Seattle 4 months ago to take a job at a geothermal energy startup that was going to build a pilot plant near Mount Rainier, the stupendous volcanic shotgun pointed at Seattle's head. She was going to do computer stuff, simulations of underground heat flow using computer codes. Richard was fascinated to hear the jargon rushing out of her mouth, to see the Zula brain unleashed on something worthy of its powers. In high school, she'd been quiet, a little too assimilated, a little too easy to please in the small-town farm girl sort of way. An all-American girl named Sue, whose official documents happened to read Zula, but now she had got in touch with her Zula-ness. "So what happened?" Richard asked, for she had been careful to say, "I was going to do this and that." "When I got there, all was chaos," she said. The look on her face was fascinated. Going from Eritrea to Iowa would definitely give a young person some interesting perspectives on chaos. Something funny was going on with the money people, one of those hedge fund Ponzi schemes. They filed for bankruptcy a month ago. "You're unemployed," Richard said. "That's one way to look at it, Uncle Richard," she said, and smiled. Now Richard had a new item on his list, which, unlike Zula's, was a stew of nagging worries, vague intentions, and dimly perceived karmic debts that he carried around in his head. Get Zula a job at Corporation 9592, and he even had a plausible way of making it happen. That was not the hard part. "What do you know about magma?" he asked. She turned slightly, looking at him sidelong. "More than you, I would guess." "You can do heat flow simulations. What about magma flow simulations?" "The capability is out there," she said. "Tensors?" Richard had no idea what a tensor was, but he had noticed that when math geeks started throwing the word around, it meant that they were headed in the general direction of actually getting something done. "I suppose," she said nervously, and he knew that his question had been ridiculous. "It's really important in a deep way that we get it right." "What, for your game company?" "Yes, for my Fortune 500 game company." She was frozen in the watchful sidelong pose, trying to make out if he was just pulling her leg. "The stability of the world currency markets is at stake," he insisted. She was not going to bite. "We'll talk later. You know anyone with autism spectrum disorder?" "Yes," she blurted out, staring at him directly now. "Could you work with someone like that?" Her eyes strayed to her boyfriend. Peter was struggling with the reloading. He was trying to put the rounds into the magazine backward. This had really been bothering Richard for the last half minute or so. He was trying to think of a non-humiliating way to mention this when Peter figured it out on his own and flipped the thing around in his hand. Richard had assumed, based on how Peter handled the gun, that he'd done it before. Now he reconsidered. This might be the first time Peter had ever touched a semi-automatic, but he was a quick study, an autodidact. Anything that was technical, that was logical, that ran according to rules, Peter could figure out and knew it, didn't bother to ask for help. So much quicker to work it out on his own than suffer through someone's well-meaning efforts to educate him and to forge an emotional connection with him in so doing. There was something somewhere that he could do better than most people, something of a technical nature. "What have you been doing, Uncle Richard?" Zula asked brightly. She might have gotten in touch with her Zula nest, but she kept the Sue nest holstered for ready use at times like this. "Waiting for cancer" would have been too honest an answer. "Fighting a bitter rearguard action against clinical depression" would have given the impression that he was depressed today, which he wasn't. "Worrying about palate drift," Richard said. Peter and Zula seemed oddly satisfied with that non-answer, as if it felt fit in perfectly with their expectations of men in their 50s. Or perhaps Zula had already told Peter everything that she knew or suspected about Richard, and they knew better than to pry. "You fly through Seattle?" Peter asked, jumping rather hastily to the last resort topic of air travel. Richard shook his head. "I drove to Spokane. Takes 3 or 4 hours, depending on snow and the wait at the border. One hop to Minneapolis, then I rented a big fat American car and drove it down here." He nodded in the direction of the road, where a maroon Mercury Grand Marquis was blotting out 2 houses of the Zodiac. "This would be the place for it," Peter remarked. He turned his head around to take in a broad view of the farm, then glanced innocently at Richard. Richard's reaction to this was more complicated than Peter might have imagined. He was gratified that Peter and Zula had identified him as one of the cool kids and were now inviting him to share their wryness. On the other hand, he had grown up on this farm, and part of him didn't much care for their attitude. He suspected that they were already Facebooking and Twittering this, that hipsters in San Francisco coffee bars were even now ROFLing and OMGing at photos of Peter with the Glock. But then he heard the voice of a certain ex-girlfriend telling him he was too young to begin acting like such a crabby old man. A second voice chimed in, reminding him that when he had rented the colossal Grand Marquis in Minneapolis, he had done so ironically. Richard's ex-girlfriends were long gone, but their voices followed him all the time and spoke to him like muses or furies. It was like having 7 superegos arranged in a firing squad before a single beleaguered id, making sure he didn't enjoy that last cigarette. The Grand Marquis was blocking an SUV full of kids and moms who had just had it with being out here in the noise and the cold. So Richard, glad of an excuse to leave, moved quickly toward it, passing between Peter and Zula. Not too loudly, he announced, "I'm going into town," which meant that he was going to Walmart. He got into the huge Mercury, heard doors opening behind him, saw Peter and Zula sliding into the plunging sofa of the back seat. The passenger door swung open too, and in came another 20-something woman whose name Richard should have known but couldn't recall. He would have to ferret it out during the drive. The young funsters had much to say about the Grand Marquis as he was gunning it out onto the road. They had got the joke of it, decided that Richard was hip. The girl in the passenger seat, she had never before been in a car like this, meaning apparently a sedan. Richard felt far beyond merely old. Their conversation flew back and forth like the twittering of birds for about 5 minutes, and then they all fell silent. Peter was not exactly chomping at the bit to divulge facts about himself. Richard was fine with that. People who had job titles and business cards could say easily where they worked and what they did for a living, but those who worked for themselves, doing things of a complicated nature, learned over time that it was not worth the trouble of supplying an explanation if its only purpose was to make small talk. Better to just go directly to airline travel. The Walmart was like a starship that had landed in the soybean fields. Richard drove past the part of it where food was sold, past the pharmacy and the eye care center, and parked at the end where they stocked merchandise. The parking spaces were platted for full-size pickup trucks, a detail useful to him now. They went inside. The young ones shuffled to a stop as their ironic sensibilities, which served them in lieu of souls, were jammed by a signal of overwhelming power. Richard kept moving since he was the one with the mission. He kept walking until everything in his field of vision was camouflage or fluorescent orange, then looked around for the ammunition counter. An elderly man came out wearing a blue vest and rested his wrinkly hands on the glass like an Old West barkeeper. Richard nodded at the man's pro forma greeting and then announced that he wanted three large boxes of the 5.56 millimeter NATO cartridges. The man nodded and turned around to unlock the glass case where the good stuff was stockpiled. On the back of his vest was a large yellow smiley face that was thrust out and made almost hemispherical by his widower's hump. Len was handing it out three rounds at a time, he explained to the others as they caught up with him. Everyone wants to fire his carbine, but no one buys ammo, and 5.56 is kind of expensive these days because all the nut jobs are convinced it's going to be banned. The clerk set the heavy boxes carefully on the glass counter, drew a pistol-shaped barcode scanner from its plastic holster, and zapped each of the three boxes in turn. Three pulls of the trigger, three direct hits. He quoted an impressively high figure. Richard already had his wallet out. When he opened it up, the niece or second cousin glanced into the valley of nice leather so indiscreetly that he was tempted to just hand the whole thing over to her. She was astonished to see the face of Queen Elizabeth and colorful pictures of hockey players and doughboys. He hadn't thought to change money, and now he was in a place with no bureaus de change. He paid with a debit card. "When did you move to Canada?" asked the young woman. 1972, he answered. The old man gave him a look over his bifocals. Draft dodger. None of the younger people made the connection. He wondered if they even knew that the country had once had a draft and that people had been at pains to avoid it. "Just need your PIN number, Mr. Forrest," said the clerk. Richard, like many who'd moved away, pronounced his name for Thrast, but he answered to Forthrast, which was how everyone here said it. He even recognized Forrest, which was what the name would probably erode into pretty soon if the family didn't up stakes. By the time they'd made it to the exit, he'd decided that the Walmart was not so much a starship as an interdimensional portal to every other Walmart in the known universe. And that when they walked out the doors past the greeters, they might find themselves in Pocatello or Wichita. But as it turned out, they were still in Iowa. So we'll... So the next bit... is shorter. It's a little piece about Zula. I guess all I really need to do to set it up is to say it happens when she's under a lot of stress in a bad situation. Zula was very tired, and her mind was in several places at once. The word flashback was much too fraught to describe what was happening in her mind, but it was the case that the mind pulled up memories that were germane to the impressions flooding into its sensory organs, and the first few years of her life related better to what was happening now than most of what she had experienced in small-town Iowa. She did not have the energy, the clarity, or what nerds denominated the bandwidth to deal with all aspects of this situation at once. Certainly the one that dominated was the sense that she was in danger. There was a technical side to it also, but neither of those explained the sick feeling that kept passing in waves through her abdomen. There was a moral aspect to this. She'd failed to see it at all until Wallace had been sent to the other room. For that, a man like Ivanov would probably see her as ridiculously naive. She could perhaps be forgiven that naivete once. Now, though, she was being asked to give up another person, a complete stranger, somewhere, who had created the ReamD virus. She had not volunteered for the job. But the Iowa girl response was always yes, especially to a polite older man in good clothes who had come such a long way. For some reason, she was remembering a moment when she had been something like 14 years old, the apex of the crystal meth epidemic in Iowa. She had been home alone and had looked out the window to see a strange van coming down the road very slowly. It had made a couple of passes by the house and then pulled into the driveway that led to their equipment shed. A couple of men had gotten out of the van, looking around nervously. Not knowing whether they might have come on a legitimate errand, Zula had made a phone call to Uncle John, as she called her second adopted dad, and Uncle John had extremely calmly talked her through the procedure of locking every door in the house, getting a shotgun and a box of shells, and hiding herself in the attic. His matter-of-fact instructions had been accompanied and sometimes drowned out by dim roaring, screeching, and thumping noises that, as she later understood, had resulted from his driving at 100 miles an hour while he talked. Zula had barely gotten the attic stairs pulled up behind her when a lot of disturbing vehicular noises had ensued from outside, and she had peered out a gable vent to see Uncle John's car in the middle of the front yard at the end of a long set of skid marks that completely surrounded the house, for he had orbited it once, checking for signs of forced entry, and John hobbling around it on his prosthetic legs to crouch behind it and use it for cover, while across the way the van screamed out onto the road with a door hanging open. A cloud of what she took for steam was rising from the side of the shed where they kept the anhydrous ammonia tank. A few minutes later, the sheriff's department was there in force, and Zula felt it safe to emerge from the attic. John yelled at her that she did not have permission to come down yet. Then he hugged her and told her that she was his wonderful girl. Then he asked about the whereabouts of the shotgun. Then he told her again how magnificent she was, and then he ordered her to go upstairs and not come out until he gave permission. She went upstairs and, peering out a window, saw what John did not want her to see, the ambulance men putting on their hazmat suits and placing a large brown wrinkled thing into a body bag. One of the thieves, startled perhaps by Uncle John's sudden advent, had made a mistake with the anhydrous ammonia line and been sprayed with the chemical which had sucked all the water out of his body. It was in that moment, but never before and rarely since, that she had perceived a kind of subterranean through line, perhaps like one of those ley lines in terrain, running from her people in Eritrea to her people in Iowa. So the last bit I'm going to read happens on a plane, a private plane, while Richard is flying from the Schloss in Elphinstone back to Seattle. He's sort of been called back because of this virus that was mentioned in the previous thing called REAMD, which is sort of running rampant in the game and causing a lot of trouble. And the description that is embedded in here is of stuff happening within the game. I'm not sure from the looks I get sometimes when I'm reading this, I'm not sure if that's totally clear to people. So, turning his attention back to matters inside the plane's cabin, Richard resumed reading the Terrain Gazette, a daily newspaper, electronic format, of course, created by a micro department operating out of the Seattle office, which summarized what had been going on all over Terrain during the preceding 24 hours. Notable achievements, wars, duels, sackings, mortality statistics, plagues, famines, untoward spikes in commodity prices. Torgai mortality hits 1,000,000% mark. Compiled from reports by Gazette correspondents Greshnach the Forsaken, Eric Bloodmace, and Lady Lacewing of Ferry. Torgai foothills. The mortality rate in this unexpectedly war-ravaged region today skyrocketed through 1,000,000%. Local observers attributed the unusual figure to an epical influence of outsiders compelled by as yet unexplained astral phenomena to pay tribute to a local troll. The visitors, or as they have come to be known to locals, meat, are laden with tribute and hence make tempting targets for highwaymen. The 1,000,000% benchmark is considered by analysts to be an important psychological barrier that separates a war-ravaged inferno from a chiliastic gore storm. Steadying himself on an 8-foot wizard's staff as he waded through a knee-high river of blood washing down the Market Street of Bagpipe Gulch, a community that once prized its status as the gateway to Torgai. Shikandar the Fearsome, a local alchemist, denied that the trend was a negative influence on the town's image, insisting that the influx of meat and the bandits, land pirates, and cutthroats who had come to prey on them had been a boon to the region's economic development and a bonanza for local merchants, especially those who, like Shikandar, dealt in goods such as healing potions and magically enhanced whetstones that were in demand among the newcomers. In the Wayfarer Inn, a popular local watering hole situated on the precipitous road leading up out of Bagpipe Gulch into the foothills, a more nuanced view of the situation could be heard in the remarks of a muffled voice, barely audible through a wall of corpses stacked all the way to the taproom ceiling and identifying itself as Goodman Bustle, the barkeep. Suggesting that all the visitors and attention might be too much of a good thing, the voice identifying itself as Bustle complained that many customers, citing as an excuse the towering rampart of decaying flesh that had completely blocked access to the bar, had departed the premises without paying their tabs. The compilers of this document all sported advanced liberal arts degrees from very expensive institutions of higher learning and wrote in this style, as Richard had belatedly realized, as a form of job security. Upper management had grown accustomed to reading the Gazette every morning over their lattes and would probably have paid these people to write it even if it hadn't been an official part of Corporation 9592's budget. The phrase, as yet unexplained astral phenomena, was a hyperlink leading to a separate article on the internal wiki. For it was an iron law of Gazette editorial policy that the world of terrain as seen through the screens of players must be treated as the ground truth, the only reality observable or reportable by its correspondents. Oddities due to the choices made by players were attributed to strange lights in the sky, eldritch influences beyond the ken of even the most erudite local observers, unlooked-for syzygy, what was most likely the intervention of a capricious local demigod, or, in one case, an unexpected reversal of fortune that even the most wizened local gaffers agreed was without precedent and that, indeed, if seen in a work of literature, would have been derided as a heavy-handed example of deus ex machina. But, of course, it was one of the Gazette staff's most important tasks to report on player behavior, that is, on things that happened in the real world, and so such phrases were always linked to non-Gazette articles written in a sort of corporate memo speak that always disheartened Richard when he clicked through to it. In this case, the explanatory memo supplied the information that the Torgai foothills were the turf of a band calling themselves the Da Ji Shu, probably an abbreviation of Da Gold Shu, makers of gold, where the truncation of gold to G was either due to the influence of gangster rap or because it was easier to type. They had been running the place for years, all pretty normal. There were many little enclaves like this. Nothing in the rules prevented a sufficiently dedicated and well-organized band of players from conquering and holding a particular stretch of ground. The meat were there because of Rimdi, which had been present at background levels for several weeks now, but that recently had pinballed through the elbow in its exponential growth curve, and for about 12 hours had looked as though it might completely take over all computing power in the universe. But it wasn't going to take over the world, and it wasn't going to bring the whole company to a stop. And in the meantime, thousands of characters were racking up experience points, slaying each other in Goodman Bustle's pub. Corvallis Kawasaki picked him up on the tarmac of the Renton Airport. He was driving the inevitable Prius. "I could have had a friggin' Lincoln Town Car," Richard complained as he stuffed himself into its front seat. "Just wanted to bend your ear a little," C-plus explained, fussing with the intermittent wiper knob, trying to dial in that elusive setting, always so difficult to find in Seattle, that would keep the windshield visually transparent but not drag shuddering blades across dry glass. They were staring straight down the runway at the southern bight of Lake Washington, which was flecked with whitecaps. It had been a choppy landing, and Richard felt a bit clammy. Corvallis had grown up in the town after which he was named, the son of a Japanese-American Kag Sai professor and an Indian biotech researcher, but culturally he was pure Oregonian. No one at the company knew exactly what he did for a living, but it was hard to imagine the place without him. He shifted the Prius into gear, or whatever it was called, when he pulled the lever that made it go forward. and proceeded at a safe and sane speed among the parked airplanes, dripping and rocking against their tie downs. I know you're going to see Devin tomorrow, and mostly what's on your mind is the war. He paused slightly before saying war, and he said it funny with a long O and heavy emphasis. "War," Richard repeated. "W-O-R," C-plus explained, "the war of realignment." Is that what the cool kids are calling it now? Yeah, I guess it works better in email than in conversation. Anyway, I know you're going to be prepping for that, but also you need to know that there are some interesting techno-legal issues coming up around REAMD. God, that sounds like just the sort of can of worms that I retired to get away from. I don't think you are actually retired, Corvallis pointed out mildly. I mean, you just flew in from Elphinstone, and tomorrow you're taking a jet to Missouri, and from there... It's a selective retirement, Richard explained. A retirement from boring shit. I think that's called a promotion. Well, whatever you call it, I don't want to drill down. Is that the expression you use? You know perfectly well that it is. Into nasty details of REAMD's legal consequences. I mean, we've had viruses before, right? We have 281 active viruses as of the last time I checked, which was an hour ago. Richard drew breath, but C-plus cut him off. And before you go where you're going, let me just point out that most of them don't actually make use of our technology as a payment mechanism. So REAMD is not just another virus. It presents new issues. Because our servers are actually being used to transfer the booty. Turns out, Corvallis warned him, that federal law enforcement types haven't yet bought into our whole mindset, and so they aren't real big on terms like booty, swag, hoard, treasure, or anything that is evocative of a fictitious medieval armed combat scenario. To them, it's all payments, and since our system uses real money, it's all, well, real. I always knew that that was going to swing around and bite me in the ass someday, Richard said. I just didn't know how or when. Well, it's bitten you in the ass lots of times, actually. I know, but each one feels like the first. The creator of the REAMD virus has made some interesting choices. Interesting in a way that's bad for us, Richard asked, because this was clearly implied by Corvallis's tone. Well, that depends on whether we want to be the avenging sword of the Justice Department here or just sort of cop out and say it's not our problem. Go on. The instructions in the eponymous file just state that the gold pieces are to be left at a particular location in the Torgai foothills. They do not say that the gold is to be mailed or transferred to any one specific character. Obviously, Richard said, because in that case we could just shut down that character's account. Right, so the way that the virus creator takes possession of the gold is by simply picking it up off the ground where it has been dropped by the victim. The gold is scattered all over the place. They anticipated we might make moves to shut them down, Richard said, so they spread things out. Apparently, so it's analogous to a situation in the real world where caches of gold have been scattered all over a rugged wilderness area hundreds of square kilometers. If that happened in the real world, Richard said, the cops would just cordon off the area. And that is exactly what cops of various nationalities are asking us to do in this case, C-plus said. Just write a script that will eject or log out every character in the Torgai foothills and prevent them from logging back in. Then go in there and collect evidence. By go in there, you just mean run a program that will identify old gold pieces in that region. Yes. And are we telling them to fuck themselves? This seemed the obvious thing to do, but Richard wouldn't put anything past Corporation 9592's current CEO. We don't have any choice, C-plus said. Richard was struck mute with admiration at the way C-plus had answered the question while imputing nothing except helplessness to the CEO. Corvallis went on, REAMD has affected users from at least 43 different countries that we know about. If we say yes to one, we have to say yes to all of them. And then our company is being micromanaged by the United Nations, Richard said. Awesome. He was way too old to use this all-purpose adjective sincerely, but was not above throwing it into a sentence for ironic effect. The legal issues are just fantastically complex, C-plus said, given all the different nationalities. So I'm not here to tell you that we've got an answer, But it helps that each individual event is a very small crime. $73 at current exchange rates, under the radar as far as serious criminal prosecution is concerned. I have a headache already, Richard said. Is there anything you actually need me to do, or are you just cluing you in? C-plus said, I'm sure that the PR staff will want some quality time with you before you go on the road. They just wanted to tell me to shut up, Richard said. I already know that. That is not the actual point. They just want to be seen as having done their jobs. Richard fell silent for a while, wondering whether there was any way that he could delegate to an underling all meetings whose sole purpose was for the people he was meeting with to demonstrate that they were doing their jobs. Then he realized he should have just stayed in the Schloss if that was what he really wanted. So that'll be the end of the reading. I think now we'll go to a question and answer mode for a bit. You guys, is there a mic for that, or are we just going to shout out? Okay. That's fine. I'll just try that. Yes.
People always come off to me as a very straight-laced, stoic kind of guy, but one of the things I love about your books is I'm always laughing. Do you find yourself to be a real humorous person?
No. Anyone else? We're done? Cool. What's the... My watch says 8:15. When did we start?
7:30.
7:30. Okay, that's why I'm confused. Okay. It gives me an idea. Oh, yes, okay. Tie-dye, then black shirt guy.
We're rocking with tie-dye, yeah. Okay, that's why you read or listen to Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And
I don't care.
You've gotten deep in sword making.
Not making.
Oh, I thought you were.
No. No, but I mean, I sort of practice it as a kind of martial arts thing. But I making them is beyond my powers. It's pretty specialized.
So where did this one take you? Is my question. Where did this book take you?
In terms of like doing actual stuff, or this one didn't need as much of that kind of thing. I made a trip to China to look at a place there. I did some playing of similar video games, some driving around BC. But some books are just more research intensive than others, and this one, being a sort of modern day techno thriller, was required a relatively small amount of research.
Yeah. I was curious. I remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's just different. Each book is a completely separate project, and you sort of have to come up with a completely different process for doing each one. And in this case, it was more about cranking out the material and less about doing a whole lot of research. So, dinosaur guy.
I went back and I reread Cryptonomicon after reading The Rogue Cycle, and I noticed that sprinkled throughout there were a lot of sort of like bits and pieces of history that appeared out of that book. When you were writing Cryptonomicon, were you thinking ahead to the Baroque cycle and leaving those clues, or did you just leave them in there as fun and then come back and tie them into the book?
So the question is, when I was writing Cryptonomicon, did I plant links back into the Baroque cycle material? And the answer is no, because when I was writing most of it, I hadn't even conceived of writing the whole Baroque cycle thing yet, but because of some contingencies that aren't really that interesting, there's a long gap between when the most of the Cryptonomicon was written and when it got published, longer than normal. And it was during that gap that I sort of came up with the idea to do the Baroque cycle and kind of blocked out roughly what it was going to be about, who was going to be in it, kind of what was going to happen. And so that made it possible for me to kind of sneak in as we were finalizing the text of Cryptonomicon and add a few hooks. Not quite as many as I wish I had added, but maybe I'll go back and fix that one of these days. Yeah.
Can you talk about how you plot a novel? I mean, what's your process for, like for this one,
How do I plot a novel? What I've found is that it's good to have an idea of what's going to happen and the general, I hate to use this word, the general arc of the thing and how it's going to end, and what the main stories are. It's generally not a good idea for me to write that down because it's not so complicated that it can't be carried in the head. And writing it down bestows on it a kind of permanency that it doesn't deserve because it's only a few hours or weeks work. And the writing of the novel can be years work. And during that time, you may come up with much better ideas on how the plot ought to go. On the other hand, you can't just wander at random, or you know, you can get into trouble. So it's a combination of having a general idea, but not being so rigidly tied to that idea that you're unwilling to take unexpected turns when your characters do things you weren't expecting them to do, or when you perceive opportunities that would make the book better. Yeah.
In a number of your books, and it sounds like in the current one, you think about money and currency and the philosophical foundations of how people think about it. Does that leak into any kind of thought of, does current events kind of set you off on these trails of thought?
So he's asking about the fact that money and currency and so on show up in a lot of my books, and is that related to current events? And, you know, the answer in this case is that I became aware, I think, as I was writing or after I'd written the Baroque cycle, that there was this thing called gold farming, which is, for those of you who don't know it, it's an industry in China and some other countries where mostly young people will play games like World of Warcraft and amass virtual property, usually just gold pieces, which they'll sell for hard money to players in the West who want to acquire things in the game, but they don't have as much time to sit there and play it and level up. So, when those stories started coming out, I thought that can't be real. It's got to be just a an exaggeration of some minor thing, but it turns out it's a huge industry. It's like billions of dollars a year, and it's getting huger all the time. There was just a story a few weeks ago to the effect that there are prisons in China where the guards are making the inmates gold farm and pocketing the money. So you know, if you buy gold in those games, you may actually be engaging in an act of slavery, you know. So I was just unbelievably bizarre. It's, you know, one of these things that's just far beyond what a science fiction writer could think up, and since it was germane to the theme that you mentioned, I thought, well, okay, maybe there's something there that I can use to build a book around. And that, so it's a mixture of it's just kind of a rolling with the punches, reading the newspapers and maybe exploiting opportunities that arise from current events. Now, anybody in the back? So way in the back behind the window.
Do you feel like you have a patent claim to Google Earth?
No. Because just in a purely technical legal sense, I didn't file, right? Even if I had, the question would be, is it obvious, right? So if it's sufficiently obvious, you can't, in theory anyway, you can't get a patent on it. So anybody else in the back? Yeah, in the white shirt way back. Well, like right now, there's I've got two ideas. I'm having trouble making up my mind which one's going to. They're like two scorpions in a bottle, you know. I'm not sure which one's going to win. And that's pretty typical. Usually there's a couple of ideas during the transition period, and at some point one of them just suddenly takes over and becomes obviously the next one I'm going to write. It's not a very rational process. There's somebody a little bit closer in that along that general radius who had their hand up a minute ago. It wasn't you, but you can ask since the other person chickened out. Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I'm just thinking about it. I wasn't confused. It's a good question. I mean, I guess I take it as an indication that I'm making decisions that are palatable to people. You know, which is a useful kind of feedback. If it were to suddenly plummet to 1/10 of its previous size, then, you know, that would pose some interesting questions for me, right? So, I mean, it's mostly it's me alone, right? I'm not consulting focus groups or looking at stats or huddling with the publisher trying to figure out what's going to be best. It has to ring true, or it's probably not going to be a good choice. Somebody, yes, front row.
One of the things I love most about your books is the way you're able to just describe environments. How do you actually like get into the mode where you're able to fill out just all those little details just to kind of jump out of them?
This is from a gentleman who thinks I'm good at describing environments, and he wants to know kind of how that process works. Thank you. I go there, and I typically what I've found is that I will see 90% of everything I'm going to see in the first, say, 12 hours, maybe even sooner than that, and then it just drops off exponentially. So staying for a week is just infinitesimally more productive than staying for a day. So I tend to do quick hits, go in and out, get what I need and bail. And that's partly because the strategy here is that, you know, what I'm selling and you're buying is the experience of getting immersed in a fictional world. And in order to achieve that immersion, I need to describe that world in a way that kind of draws you in and sounds... I don't know how it works exactly, but it does work if it's done right. And so that seems to require some detailed description of sights and smells and sounds and how things work in that world. Too much of that, and people start skipping paragraphs, skipping pages, and that leads very quickly to just closing the book and never opening it up again. So typically when I come back from a trip like that, I've got a bunch of stuff that I think is cool that I'd love to put in, and I realize that it just has to go. Like in this book, I had about a page-long description of how they make tea in Fujian, which was perfectly nice as ethnography, but it just completely stopped the action dead in the middle of in the worst possible place to do that. So I, you know, had to rip that out. And there's a bunch of that happens a lot. So so it's just a matter of calibrating and putting in enough to achieve that immersion, but not so much that it's like showing off for kind of excessive researchiness. Kind of orange shirt there. Yeah, hi.
As a science fiction author, what you do is inherently predictive. I think outside of your book into books in general, where do you see yourself as an author, and where do you see a business like Cat & Cover in 10 years, given e-readers, given Pirate Bay, given the general trend towards ephemerality?
What's your... Oh, yeah. It's a question about kind of the future of publishing in general, impact of current trends on stores like this one, that sort of thing. The conflicts aren't necessarily clear-cut. I mean, I don't know how it works here, but most bookstores, indie bookstores, they know about e-books, and there's a way to...
Yeah, actually, through the ABA, American Booksellers Association, we now, any member store who has an e-commerce website can sell Google Books. So you can get e-books from indie sites that are part of the ABA.
Yeah, so the stores are adapting, and just the mere, I mean, this is, you know, an indication that stores like Tattered Cover can do things that other kinds of stores just cannot do. And there's a lot of obviously kind of creative thinking going on in this industry as people, you know, think about the question that you just raised. For me, since I write great big fat books, the option to get them in electronic form, you know, in a number of different formats is useful. The fact that people will stand in line for an hour to get their paper book signed is also indicative of something. So I don't know if that really adds up to a coherent answer, but it's a few thoughts. So, yeah. No, I was pointing at you. Yeah, the young lady. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are they like supposed to be part of the like same family line, or like one of the characters is kind of like hinted to be like immortal? Like.
So, yeah. So she's asking about the characters or families of characters that are in common between Cryptonomicon and the Baroque Cycle: the Waterhouses, the Shaftos, the Comstocks, Enoch Root. Yeah. I mean, there's that. They're all. I don't do a lot of this, but in this case, it's clearly the case that those books are all in the same fictional universe, and that the people in Cryptonomicon are descendants of the ones in the Baroque Cycle, except for Enoch Rue, who's in a different category of, you know, which I won't get into. But the that's a case of you know, building the big saga of multiple books in one universe, definitely. Yes. You. Yes.
What does Eliza of Quilm say about or do about today's world financial system?
What would Eliza do about today's financial system? Well, yeah, I probably make a lot of money and we would all hate her. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there an intellectual order from that book that you would like your life to present?
Oh, well, I mean, I think you can kind of tell where my sympathies lie. So I don't think, you know, I'd be in the most, the nerdiest order that would have me. But I'd probably end up as a carpenter or something like that. So, yes, yes.
Oh.
Oh, thanks.
Have you ever actually quoted a real person in one of your books? Like, you're like, oh, you know, my sister said that, or my mom said that, or my uncle said it really funny.
Have I ever quoted a real person, like somebody in my family, in one of my books? I think maybe a couple of lines, like sayings that people make, but I can't bring them back. At the drop of a hat. Like the most cigarettes. I mean, that was from a friend of mine in Cryptonomicon. Yeah.
So a couple of your earlier works were collaborative. What was that like, was you writing by yourself, and did you do that again?
Two of my earlier books were collaborations between me and my uncle, Interface and The Cobweb, and so the questioner is asking what was that like as opposed to writing alone. It was a lot of time on the phone. It was fun. I mean, I enjoyed it. It's very different, obviously, from writing alone. And And it was great. I got a kick out of working in that mode. I mean, it's somebody I've known my whole life, and we get along, we understand each other, and so the relationship worked pretty well. And we went off and wrote our separate bits, and it was good. It was productive. Okay. I'm okay. So this is what we're going to maybe answer a few really, really fast here. So this is the lightning round.
I was just wondering about something it really looks like. So yeah, it tended to be like shorter.
Mm-hmm. So the lightning round isn't getting off to a good start. I mean, it's about length. It's about the increase in length and of books, and whether that was a, to what extent that was a conscious thing or just something that crept up. And a couple things about that, and this will be the last question, unfortunately, because it's going to take me a second to answer it. One thing is that the books that I've been writing for the last few years, for whatever reason, tend to be what I call cluster novels. So Cryptonomicon is actually two books that are interleaved with each other, one in World War II, one in the present day. The Baroque Cycle is eight books that are clustered together into three volumes. Anathem is one big book, but Rimdi is two. It's divided almost exactly in half. The first half is called Nine Dragons, and the second half is called American Falls. And they could have been published separately, and in an earlier era of the publishing industry, what you'd see instead of a few great big fat books on the shelf with my name on it would be a series of little normally sized mass market paperbacks that constitute series. You would have bought eight separate books for the Baroque Cycle and two separate books for Rimdi and so on. And every time I do one of these, we have the same conversation with the publisher, which is, would you like to just break this up and publish it as separate books, or just make it one huge volume? And for whatever reason, they've always opted to try to go for the minimum number of big fat books, and that's based on some logic out of the publishing industry and the economics of that industry that I don't claim to understand, but they seem to know what they're doing, so I just basically take their lead on it. The other thing is about that is that I don't you don't hear people saying I love 700 page books. My shelves at home are falling apart because of the weight of all the 700-page books that I bought since I was in college, but I don't like 900-page books. And 300-page books, I don't see why anybody gets those at all. Those 300-page books suck. But if you replace those with terms like science fiction, mystery, Western, or whatever, then that does become a sentence that you might hear people say. So what seems to happen is that as long as people are immersed in the book and enjoying it, they don't particularly care how big it is, except for the fact that they can't breathe because it's compressing their diaphragm while they're lying in bed. So there is a kind of packaging issue that arises, but in general, I haven't felt a particularly strong pressure to alter my approach to length. And since this one's doing okay, I'm still not feeling any such pressure. So anyway, I think we're going to go to signing books now. I'll just let you kind of explain how that's going to work. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.